97.1 FM Talk Podcast.
It sits above the mantle.
Second Amendment Radio and the Great Outdoors. Oh, love this song. Granddaddy's Gun by Blake Shelton, who's leaving The Voice. Everybody in the world should know by now. If you've never heard that song in its entirety, search that. Blake Shelton, Granddaddy's Gun. Good stuff.
Nice.
Why is he leaving?
How are you, buddy?
I'm good. How are you?
They're all leaving. It's going to be a turnover of, like, Adam Levine left, and he's the last original one.
He's been there 16 seasons or something like that. Something crazy. And I always think, you know, because I got an old buddy that watches that show. Did you see the singers? Did you see the singers last night? No, I gave up on that 10, 15 years ago.
I don't watch it.
When do those artists that go through that show make it big? It's rare that you see them pop.
Not on The Voice, and not even American Idol anymore.
Yeah, I know.
Used to be.
Just churn and burn.
Anyways. Kelly Clarkson is now on The Voice.
Oh, well. That's confusing.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. So, lots to get to for you here this weekend. We've got gun experts. We've got people from the National Park Service to cover the outdoor portion of the show today. And I just have to say, looking at the list, because we're going to have a list of the most visited national parks in the country. And one thing Bo and I were talking about before the show came on is, what about the Arch Grounds, right? The expansion, Jefferson National Memorial expansion.
It's beautiful. Tons of money put into it.
True. I have to wonder, though, because we have a problem in St. Louis with crime. And the bigger problem is, particularly after what happened with Jhené Edmondson and the accident, that's drawn even more attention to it. And I know a lot of people stop at the Arch Grounds as they're passing through on their way to somewhere else. But I just wonder what kind of – I wonder if we could ever know what kind of real impact that's had on who doesn't come because they're afraid to park their car and get out and walk on the Arch Grounds.
You know, here's a question, though. How many national parks are within a city limits? That would be a question, too, right? Because most of you think Grand Teton. You think where are you going, Glacier National? You know, you think rural and you think outdoors in the sky. I mean, are there a lot of national parks within city limits, like here in St. Louis? I don't know.
I would imagine not. Most of them are too big. But, you know, right. It's something to think about. Wasn't it 2 years ago we had it? Wasn't it a St. Louis Blues prospect was robbed on the Arch Grounds?
Yes.
Yeah,
so it's not immune. I mean, they have their own Rangers and everything, but they you can't keep it from encroaching upon it. And we can ask Kathy Cupper. We got public affairs specialists from the National Park Service joining us in the next segment.
Sad is they just dumped a bunch of money into it. I haven't even been to the new Arch Grounds, not for any reason, but I just, you know, we take it for granted when it's that close. But it's like it's so beautiful. They did it. They finished the grounds. It's awesome. But when's the last time you were there?
Boy, it's probably been a couple of years. Actually, I was on the grounds more recently because I went down to meet some friends down there and record a little segment for somebody who was retiring. But in terms of actually visiting the museum or going up in the arch, it's been probably 4 or 5 years, I would guess.
Yeah, it's a reality. I bet Yellowstone is on the list of top 10 in the nation because the TV show, don't you think?
It's probably helped. John Dutton. That's probably helped.
Seriously.
And you're not seeing anything like the Dutton Ranch when you're out there. I mean, you're basically driving through, seeing the outstanding wildlife and getting in long lines of traffic where the buffalo, the bison block the road where you can't get through.
I mean, that's the power of suggestion.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's advertisement because look at Urban Cowboy way back in the day in the 80s. How many cowboy hats and boots did they sell? You know what? My buddy owns Chuck's Boots in St. Peter's and Fenton. He said, we've absolutely had an increase in sales of people that are fans of the show.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Mm.
And probably lever action rifles because that's what they all carry in their scabbards, right?
Yeah.
Everybody wants their lever action 30-30 or 45-70 or something like that. Just to be prepared. Yeah, it's fun. But I've got some questions for the lady we're going to talk to because we are going to Glacier this year. In fact, we got a bunch of family members going. My brother-in-law is going and his wife and my nephews. My son is going to come out with a friend of his. We're going to have a whole horde of people out there.
Wow.
And you have to plan these things out. I mean, honestly, you've heard me say it before, but if you're planning to go to Zion or one of these national parks, don't think you can just hop in the car and go. Some of them, like Glacier, not all of them, but some of them have, they limit the number of people that can get in each day. You have to have a car pass, or you have to be in the park before 6 a.m. So you can still get in potentially if you don't have that pass to drive across the Sun Road, but you have to go really early. So it takes a little bit of planning. And if you want to camp, you've got to get on a waiting list in some cases to try to find campsites. So it does take some planning this year. And I want to talk to her about maybe how that's changed through through COVID.
And with your big group that's going out out west this year, did you inspire them to get into the RV lifestyle, or did they inspire you?
No, we inspired them. And in fact, their plan is to fly out there and then rent one once they get there.
Oh,
because they don't own one. So it's not a matter of them having one. They can hook up to a truck and pull out there. So that's a big business, too. And
oh, it's
certainly
huge.
During COVID, those rental RVs became hard to find because everybody wanted to do it. Rental cars
became
hard to find.
And they're not cheap to rent, but you're still not paying for the whole RV.
Right.
MB Thomas has done, I rented a couple of years ago from them. And it's expensive. It's $300-$400 a day sometimes, depending on what you're getting. But at least you don't have it sitting in your driveway, or you're not paying rent at an RV storage place, which, by the way, my wife and I observe this all the time. There are RV storage places all over.
Everywhere.
That's a huge business.
Well, it's become bigger since COVID. And I told you when I got my my first camper, right in the middle of COVID, I could not find, I drew a circle. I didn't want to drive 60 miles to store my camper. So I drew a circle in the immediate area that I was interested in, and I started calling storage unit areas. And I wanted outdoor parking. I wasn't even looking for something covered. And they were all full. I could not find one within a reasonable driving distance that I wanted to drive my camper to, where I felt they had the security and all that. I couldn't find a spot. And finally, a friend reached out and said, "Hey, we've got a little room in a small barn we have for your little camper. You can put it in there." So that worked out really well for me.
So great to have friends like that,
yeah,
isn't it?
I mean, it
just is. Because a lot of people don't, they're at the RV place and they're the dealership and they're like, okay, this is the one they're going to get, not even thinking about what they're going to do with it when they, finish that trip.
Yeah, because you're not using it 90% of the time, unless you're living in it and traveling all over the country. You're just not using it.
And I think of, people that, have to deal with critter damage if they're sitting out in a field or something like that. That's another issue. And it's got to be expensive to use one of these RV rental spots, I would think. $100 a month?
If indoor storage, probably less than that for outdoor storage. But
maybe
50, 60. Depends on how big the camper is and all that stuff, and how much security they provide and everything. So
you better do buy your own piece of property out in the woods and just park it there.
All you've wanted to know about visiting national parks, the number of people that they set records a few years ago, and the most popular ones, is coming up here in just a couple of minutes. We will phone in to Kathy Cupper, who's a public affairs specialist with the National Park Service. I'm going to see if she'll give me any insight on grabbing me a campsite at Glacier this summer.
That's the hookup right there.
Maybe
pun intended.
Not on the air? Maybe off the air?
Oh, yeah. Maybe I'll call her off the air. I'm just kidding.
Are you?
Did you miss my pun? The hookup.
I got it. That was nice.
Okay.
Very nice, Bo Matthews. I was too busy looking at Carl. Sorry. We're going to get to all that and more coming up on Second Amendment Radio and the Great Outdoors. Granddaddy's gone.
Sits above the mantle on a couple rusty nails, and it's worth a bunch of money, but it damn sure ain't for sale.
Radio and the Great Outdoors. In here with Bo Matthews and Carl Middleman. I'm Mark Cox. And, happy that you're with us today. You know, I have to ask this, Bo. When's the last time you went to the Arch?
Oh, my. Too long. I haven't been to the new grounds.
We take it
and
for,
that's been how long?
We take it for granted, right? I do. I right used to here work in the Channel 4 building, which is directly across the street, and I used to go down there and walk for exercise after my morning show, but it's been a while. When you got a gym like that right around the corner, and you just kind of take it for granted, which is a shame. We're talking about national parks and the National Park Service and places around the country that are popular and growing in popularity. And we've got Kathy Kupper with us today, public affairs specialist with the Park Service. Kathy, welcome into the program.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you. You know, I mentioned that because we're going to talk in a little while about the most visited United States parks. But before we get to that list, and I guess the Arch Grounds is going to be on there somewhere, right? We need to talk about visitation numbers overall. Were they down last year, just out of interest, coming out of COVID?
Well, actually, last year there were about 312 million visitors to all the national parks throughout the country. So that's a slight increase, about a 5% increase over the year before. And so we're beginning to approach pre-COVID numbers. The top years for national parks were when we were celebrating our centennial, our 100th anniversary in 2016, 2017. So they were the record years of about 331 million. Just prior to COVID, we had about 327. And so, again, we're beginning to move up towards that figure.
It is cool to hear some of these facts about national parks, because it is a true treasure. I don't know, Kathy, I don't know any other country on the planet that has a national park system like the U.S. does. And there's so many great benefits. And I believe that those numbers are going to start to increase because we saw the influx of the RV and the camping world during COVID. People wanted to get outside and get fresh air. Do you think that contributes to the building numbers?
Yes, it certainly does. And just to back up for a second, I mean, the Yellowstone National Park was the world's first national park. And so the idea started in the United States. And as I mentioned, our park system's over 100 years old. So there are national park systems throughout the world, but we were the first with the idea to really open up public land for people to enjoy, not set aside for maybe a privileged few to enjoy the beautiful landscapes. And so the idea has caught on around the world, and there are great national parks all over the globe. But, of course, we are very proud of the 424 national parks in the United States.
Go ahead. No, please, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. And I was going to mention, when you talk about RVs, the overnight stays in national parks were very similar to what they were pre-COVID. So although the overall number is down a little bit, the people that are actually going longer and staying overnight are about the same as pre-COVID. So I think, like you mentioned, the pandemic really gave people that opportunity or incentive to get out and enjoy nature, maybe explore places they didn't know about or hadn't been before, and get out and get some exercise and enjoy the great outdoors.
Yeah, I'm one of them, Kathy. I just have to tell you, we got a camper during COVID, and we have now upgraded it already. We're going to go to Glacier again this year. The reason that I was of the mistaken belief that attendance must have gone up during COVID is that, for example, the number of visitors allowed into the park at Glacier, they started limiting that. You had to get a pass to get in, to drive across the Going to the Sun Road and all that. My assumption was that was because the number of visitors had increased so much, they had to somehow limit access a little bit. Is that wrong?
No, it's just when we look at the overall numbers for the National Park Service, it includes a lot of historic sites, so buildings that you'd have to enter that were closed during COVID.
Okay.
So some of them are just in the stages now of reopening to normal hours, and so that's why you might see that drop overall. But as you mentioned, right, a lot of the wide-open natural areas did see increases. Some were closed, of course, the first month or two of the pandemic. And then as they opened up, they did receive, large numbers of visitors. So, yes, many of those places where you could get outside and hike enjoy the outdoors. Saw bumps in visitation during COVID.
So I need you to give me a little inside baseball here. See if you can shed any light on this for me. my wife and I we have been diligent about this because we're going to Glacier in July, and we have been trying to get campsites in Mini Glacier and a couple of the campsites, Apgar, inside of the park. And I cannot believe how competitive that is. Like, we're told that at 9 a.m. Eastern time or 9 a.m. Central time, 10 a.m. Eastern time, 6 months out from the day you want to go, you can log on to recreation.gov and you can try to secure a campsite. And we've been beaten repeatedly in our attempts to secure one of those sites. I don't know what the trick is, but is there a trick, or is it just you got to be lucky?
Well, now you know Kathy Kupper, so that might help.
Well, yeah, now I got somebody on the inside.
Yeah, well, you're doing it right. I mean, the thing is to set up your rec.gov account so you have your passwords, you're all set to go. And so when that time frame opens up, you can start hitting and try to get that spot. They are very popular. The park does have some first-come, first-served campsites as well, or campgrounds, so that those that can't get reservations can, enter the park and have the option that way. There are also other public lands around Glacier that you might be able to get spots at, maybe nearby national forests or other state park recreation area that might have campsites available. If you do obtain lodging, whether in one of the lodges in Glacier or obviously with your RV in a campsite, that does mean that you don't need to get the other reservation to enter the park in the summer months.
Yeah, you get a pass. Mm-hmm. You get your pass. So yeah, that's a good thing. Thank you.
Wow. Sure. Or you're going to park it at Walmart, the nearest Walmart to the national park. It seems like it's easier to get Taylor Swift tickets than to get a spot. So I always want to ask, in every line of work out there, from fast food to medical to law enforcement, everybody's having a tough time hiring. Do the national parks have a tough time hiring, or is there a need there? And if so, what information can we put out for our listeners that, heck, they may want to be interested in applying?
Sure. We encourage anybody who's interested to apply. The jobs are posted on usajobs.gov. And so if you go there, it'll list all the National Park Service jobs. Also, there's concessions, hotels, bookstores. So partners of the Park Service that also hire. So anything from, driving a bus, to operating a bookstore, to being a waiter or waitress. So, it's a great way to spend a summer or look for a career opportunity. So there are many job opportunities available. It's always been pretty competitive to become a park ranger, but certainly, it's worth looking into it and applying. We get many people through the years who come to the Park Service as sort of a second career or even in retirement come, or people that work in the summer that have maybe are teachers or other jobs throughout the year, and then they come and they work in the summer for the National Park Service.
Yeah.
I'd say that the difficulty in hiring right now in some parks is just if they're more remote, is housing, because of the influx of people now renting their homes or people. Sometimes it's hard for somebody who's a seasonal to find housing because the rents have gone up now in nearby locations. And so we're working on that, trying to obtain more housing so that if you're able to come and work in one of the remote parks, you'll have housing as part of the job opportunity.
And I'll just have to say, as I mentioned, we've been to Glacier twice in recent years. We're going again this year. The Park Service employees, that the rangers that you meet in the park, just couldn't be any nicer. And they're so patient because they must be asked the same question 1,000 times a day. We'll see them along the side of the road trying to save tourists from themselves when they're watching bears. You have to have a certain breed of person who wants to do that job, and they do a great job. I'll just say that.
is that we love it, and you know, we're passionate about, you know, the history or the nature, and love sharing that. And so, I mean, there's nothing better than having somebody have maybe what you might call the light bulb moment or the aha when you can explain, you know, what type of tree that is or why this animal acts that way or the significance of this building, and people can, you know, see it and experience it through multiple senses and really become connected to their national park. So, I mean, that thrills, you know, all of us in the National Park Service.
Kathy Kupper is our guest public affairs specialist with the National Park Service. Okay, so we have to know, we are based out of St. Louis, although the app takes our show everywhere. Did St. Louis and the Gateway National Monument, the Arch, did it make the top 10?
It did not make the top 10.
Oh!
But there's about 1.6 million people a year who went to the Gateway Arch last year. You have another National Park Service site in the state, Ozark National Scenic Riverways, that had 1.3 million. So they are definitely among the more popular national parks throughout the country.
No doubt. So let's go down the top 10. I have to tell you, I was shocked, not surprised at what the number one was, but how far and away the number one was in terms of visitation numbers, Kathy.
Yeah, so the most visited national park in the country is the Blue Ridge Parkway, and they had about 15.7 million visitors. The third most visited is Great Smoky Mountains National Park, which is adjacent to the Blue Ridge Parkway, and they had almost 13 million. So when you look at parks like that that are large, and the Blue Ridge Parkway is linear, and they're, you know, on the East Coast where there's large population centers, so you can see that they're perfect for whether you want to do a destination vacation and really spend a week, you know, in nature, or if you just have an afternoon or a weekend and you want to get away and experience the outdoors. So you'll see most of the most visited national parks are kind of that idea. They're near large population centers and have large outdoor spaces.
Yeah, and so run down the rest then after that, because the drop-off is pretty significant. Zion was, what, number two on that list or three?
Yes, when you look at national parks, so in the National Park Service, we have 424 what we call national parks, small and small P's. So they include recreation areas, parkways, seashores, lakeshores. Out of the 424, there are 63 designated as national parks. And so the most visited of the national parks is Great Smoky Mountains. And then after that, you have the Grand Canyon and then Zion.
Oh, wow. And the drop off is 15 million. And then the next one is in the 5 million range, right?
Yes, when you're looking at the national parks. So, for instance, Great Smoky Mountains is 13 million, and then Grand Canyon is 4.7 million.
Wow. And then just hit the rest of the top 10 for us. Do you have them in front of you?
So then you have Zion, Rocky Mountain, Acadia in Maine, Yosemite, Yellowstone, Joshua Tree, Cuyahoga Valley in Ohio, Glacier. There you go. Glacier is number 31 overall, but you know, up in the top 10 for national park sites.
Yeah,
Grand Teton and Hot Springs, Olympic, and on and on.
Don't tell those of us who are trying to get reservations that it's number 31, because it seems like number one to me. I'm just saying. Kathy Kupper, listen, thank you so much for your time. Is there a good website you direct people to for more information on the national parks and how to explore them?
Yes, for sure. Visit nps.gov. And it will have details about every national park. We always say start your visit to a national park at nps.gov. And we also have the NPS app, which can help guide you and tell you everything you want to know, things to do, things to see. If you need a reservation, help you plan that great, enjoyable, safe visit to a national park.
I'm calling Kathy Kupper. I don't know about everybody else, but no, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, Kathy, do you happen to have a website for Taylor Swift tickets? I'm kidding. Thank you so much for joining us. Keep up the great work. You explained it really well. We really appreciate you joining us on Second Amendment Radio and the Great Outdoors.
Thanks for having us. Take care.
All right. Thank you. Good luck with record-breaking numbers. Man, it's going to be crazy. People are just coming out of hibernation. All right. It seems like President Biden is seeking more gun background checks with a new executive action. What? We're going to talk about that coming up next on Second Amendment Radio and the Great Outdoors. Stay right there.
love. I put my hands up.
Second Amendment Radio in the great outdoors. I'm Bo Matthews along with Mark Cox, and our executive producer gets credit on the show as well. Carl Middleman is here. This segment is brought to you. Yeah, you only get one pew pew per show.
That's right.
This segment is brought to you by Razorback Armory. They are arming America. If you are looking for knowledge, accessories, customization, go to RazorbackArmory.com, get their address, and then head to, or just go into Google Maps and just say, take me to Razorback Armory. It's right on Manchester Road, a half mile east of 270. You're going to love the guys. You're going to love the store. Razorback Armory, tell them Bo sent you in.
One thing we talk about on here a lot, Bo, is the fact that our Second Amendment rights are constantly being attacked. And sometimes they're being attacked in the courts. Sometimes they're being attacked with a pen and a signature on a piece of paper called an executive order. The president announced some new executive actions last week, and we wanted to know what's the real impact of that. I mean, he's talking about creating universal background checks without doing it through Congress. Is that even possible? I don't think so. But we decided we were going to ask the armed attorneys, one of whom is Richard Hayes, an attorney and a gun expert, and he's joining us this morning. Richard, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Mark. Thanks, Bo. Great to talk to y'all.
Absolutely. And you get the nickname Armed Attorneys from your YouTube channel, right?
That's right. Yes, I'm a co-host with my law partner, Emily Taylor, covering, 2A news, Second Amendment Simplified, and kind of self-defense practical, frequently asked questions. Because if the only thing you know is the law, then you're in big trouble.
Boy, that is well said. And, I'm talking about this story with the president and him trying to encourage more universal background checks through executive action. I'm not quite sure how he's going to accomplish that. Have you looked at this at all?
Yeah, so the emphasis seems to be, and this is on the heels of the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act, and what they're looking at is redefining what constitutes someone who's engaging in the business and dealing in firearms. And so the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act took us a huge leap forward in that direction to try to eliminate private firearms transfers, whether that's between family members or friends, or just private sellers. And what they're trying to do is to force everybody to go through these gun stores. And it's kind of a three-step process we see here. Because first, they're forcing everyone to go to the gun stores in order to get these background checks to facilitate the transfers of firearms. These gun stores are not allowed to destroy these records. They have to keep these firearms transaction records forever. And then the federal government is coming in on the back end and running these stores out of business. And when they do that, they have to turn over their records to the federal government, therefore facilitating the construction of a federal gun registry. So it's a really dangerous step in the wrong direction. And we've been saying slippery slope for a long time. We're sliding down the slope right now.
Wow.
And those documents, would you agree, Richard, are artifacts that can be reached back to and put into a database if the left does get their way on gun control. And no question about the term gun control is truly about control. When you think about other countries that have gone this way, it's never ended well. So we need to do everything that we can to uphold our Second Amendment. But those artifact documents, they go into a database for future reference, kind of like law enforcement used to collect DNA, 40 years ago before the technology was around. Yeah,
exactly right. And if we look at history, we look at the precursor to confiscation is always registration. They don't know who to take the guns from unless and they can't take guns from folks until they know who has them. And so we look at other countries, we look at registration, and we see where it leads, and we have to be opposed to that.
Yeah. Let's talk for a moment from your legal perspective. Again, we're talking to Richard Hayes, one of the armed attorneys on the YouTube channel, and he's also with Walker & Taylor, a full-service criminal and civil defense attorney firm in Houston. Let's talk about the Bruin case. I was hopeful when that happened that it would immediately cause trigger lawsuits around the country. I think that's happened. But the court system churns slowly. I keep waiting for them to come out and rule against this New York law or that California law, or maybe the fact that you have to have a firearm owner ID card in the state of Illinois next to us over here across the river. But none of those things have happened yet. I mean, why is the reaction to this taking so long?
Well, it's we got to take the good with the bad. The good, we got this incredible standard by which we judge Second Amendment infringements. That came out of the case. The bad, when courts are evaluating an issue, they have to limit themselves to the issue that's directly in front of them at the time that they're ruling. You know, they can't reach outside of the case and pick up new facts that they maybe want to evaluate. And so as a result, what that means is, and what I would compare this to, is the reaction to some governments in response to the civil rights movement. You know, because we have this narrowly tailored decision to this specific issue, the licensing issue in New York, we see all of these jurisdictions going haywire, trying to pass all these different laws that would just skirt around or be nuanced or just be differentiated slightly than the New York case. But, and where I'm hopeful, and this is why I compare it to the civil rights movement, it took about a decade for things to get sorted out. But when the dust settled, the landscape was much better off than we were before. And so I'm hopeful that, you know, it does move slowly, and, you know, believe you me, if I could flip a switch, I would definitely have all this stuff resolved tomorrow. But I'm very hopeful in the next decade, when all the dust settles, I think we're going to be on the right side of all this.
That's good.
Wow. Love that positive attitude about it, Richard Hayes. Thank you for putting that out there, because there's a lot of people that are, you know, just really, you know, bummed out about the way things are going, and you're giving us a little hope here. You know, I've always said, you know, why don't we start with the criminals, with the illegal guns? Show us that you can do something with that before we start talking about background checks for law-abiding citizens, because it's getting nuts. I mean, there's been people that have moved. I personally know people that have moved out of the state of Illinois, which is just across the river, but it's because they're coming down so hard on the gun laws over there.
Yeah, it's very sad because, and we see this trend, and it creates this incredible question about how we deal with these repeat violent offenders in these big cities, these overwhelmed judicial systems. But what I find as a criminal practitioner, I mean, the people who have the most to lose are the law-abiding. And it's this question, the law, and I don't know how we fix it. I mean, we debate this in our law firm every day. You know, how do we find a solution? You know, unfortunately, the system treats these 25 to life, you know, gang members, repeat offenders, they treat them the same as law-abiding folks who act in self-defense, and maybe they made, you know, a rush or they were scared and they made an unreasonable decision in the heat of the moment. And so how do we find a solution that punishes those that deserve to be punished but takes into account, you know, folks whenever they're actually defending themselves? It's tough, but we see these rogue DAs in big cities going hard after law-abiding, and especially when it comes to gun owners, because they have everything to lose.
Well, Richard, you know, I'm sure you saw the unfortunate case in Colorado this week where a student went into a school and shot two administrators and ended up taking his own life. You know, I host a morning radio show here, and the day after that happened, the first stories I saw were the politicians that lined up in Colorado to blame it on the gun violence issue. That was, each one of them said, we must do something about the scourge of gun violence in America. But as you read the article in the Denver Post about what happened, when you finally get down to about the 11th paragraph, you realize this kid was a very troubled individual. So troubled, in fact, he'd been kicked out of another high school and was allowed to go to this high school only if he could be patted down and searched every morning as he entered the school so they could make sure he wasn't carrying a weapon. That's a mental health issue that they ignored, and they let the kid come to school there anyway. What, my question would be, why was he ever even allowed to step foot in that school if they were that worried about him? And yet the politicians are going to try to turn this into a gun issue.
Yeah, that's about as extreme of an example as you can get, where they have correctly identified a threat and chose to do nothing. If there isn't an example, I mean, if you know someone is so dangerous that you have to search them every single day, I can't think of a more invasive law. And it didn't solve the problem.
Throw down your guns, throw down your guns in the name of love. I put my hands up.
Second Amendment Radio and the Great Outdoors. I'm Bo Matthews along with Mark Cox, and our executive producer gets credit on the show as well. Carl Middleman is here. This segment is brought to you. Yeah, you only get one pew-pew per show.
That's right.
This segment is brought to you by Razorback Armory. They are arming America. If you are looking for knowledge, accessories, customization, go to RazorbackArmory.com, get their address, and then head to, or just go into Google Maps and just say, take me to Razorback Armory. It's right on Manchester Road, a half mile east of 270. You're going to love the guys. You're going to love the store. Razorback Armory, tell them Bo sent you in.
One thing we talk about on here a lot, Bo, is the fact that our Second Amendment rights are constantly being attacked. And sometimes they're being attacked in the courts. Sometimes they're being attacked with a pen and a signature on a piece of paper called an executive order. The president announced some new executive actions last week, and we wanted to know what's the real impact of that. I mean, he's talking about creating universal background checks without doing it through Congress. Is that even possible? I don't think so. But we decided we were going to ask the armed attorneys, one of whom is Richard Hayes, an attorney and a gun expert, and he's joining us this morning. Richard, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Mark. Thanks, Bo. Great to talk to y'all.
Absolutely. And you get the nickname Armed Attorneys from your YouTube channel, right?
That's right. Yes, I'm a co-host with my law partner, Emily Taylor, covering, 2A news, Second Amendment Simplified, and kind of self-defense practical, frequently asked questions, because if the only thing you know is the law, then you're in big trouble.
Boy, that is well said. And, I'm talking about this story with the president and him trying to encourage more universal background checks through executive action. I'm not quite sure how he's going to accomplish that. Have you looked at this at all?
Yeah, so the emphasis seems to be, and this is on the heels of the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act, and what they're looking at is redefining what constitutes someone who's engaging in the business and dealing in firearms. And so the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act took us a huge leap forward in that direction to try to eliminate private firearms transfers, whether that's between family members or friends, or just private sellers. And what they're trying to do is to force everybody to go through these gun stores. And it's kind of a three-step process we see here. Because first, they're forcing everyone to go to the gun stores in order to get these background checks to facilitate the transfers of firearms. These gun stores are not allowed to destroy these records. They have to keep these firearms transaction records forever. And then the federal government is coming in on the back end and running these stores out of business. And when they do that, they have to turn over their records to the federal government, therefore facilitating the construction of a federal gun registry. So it's a really dangerous step in the wrong direction. And we've been saying slippery slope for a long time. We're sliding down the slope right now.
Wow.
And those documents, would you agree, Richard, are artifacts that can be reached back to and put into a database if the left does get their way on gun control. And no question about the term gun control is truly about control. When you think about other countries that have gone this way, it's never ended well. So we need to do everything that we can to uphold our Second Amendment. But those artifact documents, they go into a database for future reference, kind of like law enforcement used to collect DNA, 40 years ago before the technology was around. Yeah,
exactly right. And if we look at history, we look at the precursor to confiscation is always registration. They don't know who to take the guns from unless they can't take guns from folks until they know who has them. And so we look at other countries, we look at registration, and we see where it leads, and we have to be opposed to that.
Yeah. Let's talk for a moment from your legal perspective. Again, we're talking to Richard Hayes, one of the armed attorneys on the YouTube channel, and he's also with Walker & Taylor, a full-service criminal and civil defense attorney firm in Houston. Let's talk about the Bruin case. I was hopeful when that happened that it would immediately cause trigger lawsuits around the country. I think that's happened. But the court system churns slowly. I keep waiting for them to come out and rule against this New York law or that California law, or maybe the fact that you have to have a firearm owner ID card in the state of Illinois next to us over here across the river. None of those things have happened yet. I mean, why is the reaction to this taking so long?
Well, it's we got to take the good with the bad. The good, we got this incredible standard by which we judge Second Amendment infringements. That came out of the case. the bad. When courts are evaluating an issue, they have to limit themselves to the issue that's directly in front of them at the time that they're ruling. You know, they can't reach outside of the case and pick up new facts that they maybe want to evaluate. And so as a result, what that means is, and what I would compare this to, is the reaction to some governments in response to the civil rights movement. You know, because we have this narrowly tailored decision to this specific issue, the licensing issue in New York, we see all of these jurisdictions going haywire, trying to pass all these different laws that would just skirt around or be nuanced or just be differentiated slightly than the New York case. But, and where I'm hopeful, and this is why I compare it to the civil rights movement, it took about a decade for things to get sorted out. But when the dust settled, the landscape was much better off than we were before. And so I'm hopeful that, you know, it does move slowly. And, you know, believe you me, if I could flip a switch, I would definitely have all this stuff resolved tomorrow. But I'm very hopeful in the next decade when all the dust settles, I think we're going to be on the right side of all this.
That's good.
Wow. Love that positive attitude about it, Richard Hayes. Thank you for putting that out there, because there's a lot of people that are, you know, just really, you know, bummed out about the way things are going. And you're giving us a little hope here. You know, I've always said, you know, why don't we start with the criminals, with the illegal guns? Show us that you can do something with that before we start talking about background checks for law-abiding citizens, because it's getting nuts. I mean, there's been people that have moved. I personally know people that have moved out of the state of Illinois, which is just across the river, but it's because they're coming down so hard on the gun laws over there.
Yeah, it's very sad because, and we see this trend, and it creates this incredible question about how we deal with these repeat violent offenders in these big cities, these overwhelmed judicial systems. But what I find as a criminal practitioner, I mean, the people who have the most to lose are the law-abiding. And it's this question, the law, and I don't know how we fix it. I mean, we debate this in our law firm every day. You know, how do we find a solution that, you know, unfortunately, the system treats these 25 to life, you know, gang members, repeat offenders, they treat them the same as law-abiding folks who act in self-defense, and maybe they made, you know, a rush or they were scared and they made an unreasonable decision in the heat of the moment. And so how do we find a solution that punishes those that deserve to be punished but takes into account, you know, folks whenever they're actually defending themselves? It's tough, but we see these rogue DAs in big cities going hard after law-abiding, and especially when it comes to gun owners, because they have everything to lose.
Well, Richard, you know, I'm sure you saw the unfortunate case in Colorado this week where a student went into a school and shot two administrators and ended up taking his own life. You know, I host a morning radio show here, and the day after that happened, the first stories I saw were the politicians that lined up in Colorado to blame it on the gun violence issue. That was, each one of them said, we must do something about the scourge of gun violence in America. But as you read the article in the Denver Post about what happened, when you finally get down to about the 11th paragraph, you realize this kid was a very troubled individual. So troubled, in fact, he'd been kicked out of another high school and was allowed to go to this high school only if he could be patted down and searched every morning as he entered the school so they could make sure he wasn't carrying a weapon. That's a mental health issue that they ignored, and they let the kid come to school there anyway. What, my question would be, why was he ever even allowed to step foot in that school if they were that worried about him? And yet the politicians are going to try to turn this into a gun issue.
Yeah, that's about as extreme of an example as you can get, where they have correctly identified a threat and chose to do nothing. If there isn't an example, I mean, if you know someone is so dangerous that you have to search them every single day, I can't think of a more invasive law. And it didn't solve the problem. I mean, I think on the other hand, there they softened the schools. They took school resource officers out of the schools. Well, we see that didn't work either. And so I hope people, I don't know why they leave their common sense at the door. We have to make our schools hard targets. We cannot put our most precious assets in our country, our children, in these places that are shooting galleries. I mean, criminals respond to incentives, and if they know that they're not going to encounter armed resistance when they go to a place, they're more likely to select that as a target than a place where they think that they might encounter, you know, armed resistance. And so,
of course,
I don't know why these folks don't use their common sense. I mean, that's really what it is.
It's ironic you use that term, common sense, because that's exactly the words that Joe Biden used. It's just common sense. He signed the new executive action expanding gun background checks. It's just common sense. Well, somebody doesn't have common sense in this conversation. Richard, just curious, at your law firm, not that you want to talk about specifics, but did Mark McCloskey ever call you up to defend him?
Can't release client information. But I will tell you, we did author a bill that would have prevented what happened to the McCloskeys, you know, happened to them in Missouri, to prevent that from happening in Texas. And right now we have the Texas legislature in session. You know, we see it, that they're a perfect example. Everything to lose, hard on the paint, DA wanting to make an example. I mean, yeah. I'll tell you, criminals pick up on this stuff.
Sure. Sure they do.
So,
yeah.
So in your firm, what type of cases are you dealing with mostly, if it's Second Amendment related?
So we handle almost exclusively self-defense cases.
Gotcha.
And so
Okay, good.
The most common self-defense cases we see out there, I mean, this isn't very exciting, but we see a lot of road rage cases, a lot of neighbor disputes. We see a lot of people getting robbed. A lot of people getting attacked by animals. I mean, when you train, it's the same thing for like emergency preparedness. You got to prepare for the most likely scenarios that you would find yourself in. You live in the coast, prepare for a hurricane. Sure. You live in the mountains, prepare for a blizzard. You know, those are the most common scenarios that we see in our practice.
Yeah, I wonder about that. You know, I don't know if you have an opinion on this or not. I don't know if it's something that you guys offer or not, but I know that there are there are companies out there that will offer you insurance as a concealed carry holder. And often some of those come with free legal advice if you're on the scene of a shooting. Do you have any opinion on those? Maybe what's best and what's not?
Ooh, good question.
Yeah, so we work closely with one such organization, and the Texas rules on ethics kind of prevent us from talking about it.
Okay.
I will say, do your research. They're not all created equally, and there are ones out there that do what they say that they do.
Okay.
And so if you're a consumer, go do your research. Pick the one that you think fits your needs. But having immediate access to an attorney following a critical incident is absolutely crucial. And, you know, for your audience, you know, let's say you just like you go to the range, you prepare, you know, to get on target. You have to think about these scenarios, the legal aftermath, should you find yourself in a defensive scenario. Because the time to be looking up a lawyer on Google or flipping through the Yellow Pages isn't at 3 a.m. when your ears are ringing and your eyes are adjusting to the flash of your muzzle. I mean, that's not the right time to come up with a plan to find a lawyer. So you need to think about these things in advance. And just knowing who to call, I mean, that's 80% of the battle. But planning, you know, how are you going to talk to 911? What are you going to do when the police show up and talk to you on scene? What happens if they keep asking you the same questions over and over again? You know, you need to think these things through, because there are right and wrong answers.
Yeah, very true. That's Richard Hayes, a Houston-based attorney with the Walker and Taylor, and also a member of the Armed Attorneys show on YouTube. Richard, listen, we appreciate your sound advice this morning. Thank you.
Absolutely. Happy to talk to y'all anytime. Y'all have a great day.
Yes, sir. Good to get him on here. Some good advice there, Bo. You know, I don't know. I looked at, I think I was a member of the U.S. Concealed Carry Association for a while. And then there's another one that offers insurance to cover you if you're sued, but doesn't necessarily offer legal access. So I think that's something that if somebody carries, that they have to look at. You have to consider that at least. It's an expense, yes, but how much, you know, if you shoot somebody and it's not a fatal shooting, or even if it is, you're going to end up facing civil suits at some point.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting, because the first time I did the CCW training, I remember the guy saying, okay, it's not so much the importance of what happened when you shot them. It's what happened moments before.
Yes.
Yeah, have you ever heard that before?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's that's why I just suggest everybody take that concealed carry training, whether they prefer constitutional carry or not. Some good advice there, I think. All right, that's going to do it for this edition of Second Amendment Radio and the Great Outdoors. Flies by when you're having fun. Right, Bo Matthews?
Exactly, exactly. Have a great rest of your weekend. Thanks for listening, and share the show, please. See you, boys.
Get more at 971talk.com.